You're listening to The Rush, Digging into Addiction, from WSKG News. I'm Crystal Sirakis. Turning now to the biology of addiction, what happens to your brain on drugs? Well, Dr. Ruben Baller is a health scientist with the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Dr. Baller, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
What happens in the brain when it becomes addicted to opioids?
Well, there's nothing particularly specific about opioids. The process is quite a generic project, a process that happens with any drug of abuse to one extent or another. We can think of addiction as if it were really a learning process. Actually, at the synapse level, at the level of the neurons and the connecting points between neurons, the process is very similar to learning. And if you ever learn how to ride a bicycle, and you know how difficult it would be to unlearn how to ride the bicycle, this is pretty much what happens with addiction. It's something that we learn. It leaves very profound marks in the learning processes of the brain. And this is why it's so difficult to unlearn and why relapses are so frequent, because this is something that the brain learns very profoundly, very powerfully, and it's very difficult to get rid of.
If you have one person who can take painkillers and they have no issue, and then you might have a person who takes them and becomes addicted, what's the difference between those two people?
Well, there are many, many differences that we call inter-individual differences that make up for very different values in their individual risk. Some of those factors have to do with genetics. We knew all along for many years that there is a very heavy genetic load that we bring with our hereditary factors. About 50% of the overall risk of abusing a substance, of gravitating towards substances of abuse, and then becoming addicted can be ascribed to genetic factors. Biological risk, an underlying biological risk for addiction, is one of the things that today we know doctors should ask for when planning for a long-term pain management for chronic pain. But then there is another, about half, that's a rule of thumb, of factors that are outside of our genes that have to do with our environments, our social milieu, our parental style, our neighborhoods, all sorts of factors, and you can list thousands of these little factors that are outside of our biology that have a very profound impact on that risk. So it's really the convergence and the confluence of all those factors that will determine the individual risk for addiction.
If you compare a non-addicted person's body to an addicted person's body, what differences exist?
The main differences that you can find is in the way that circuitry works in the brain. The circuitry that has to do with addiction begins in a very primitive part of the brain that we share with reptiles, and it has to do with all these behaviors that we call either attraction or avoidance. Chronic drug use begins to cause plastic changes, long-term changes in the part of the brain that processes reward. The problem with addiction is not just the reward processes that become corrupted with the chronic use of drug, but addiction really entails this ever-expanding wave of dysfunction. That it really starts in the processing, in the circuitry of reward, but it then begins to compromise other circuits having to do with memory, with the way we regulate emotions, with the way we process motivation, and eventually, in the really addicted, the heavy duty addicted individuals, those that have been using drugs for a long, long time, it can really compromise the parts of the brain that are engaged in higher cognitive function, particularly the prefrontal cortex, which is that part of the brain in charge of allowing us to make proper decisions, to ponder the consequences of our actions, to inhibit our prepotent impulses. In a way, this is the part of the brain that is in charge of our free will. So this is impairments in this area are those impairments that allow us to say that when addiction reached that point, we are really talking about the bona fide disease of the brain.
And when we're talking about addiction, a lot of people say it's just a matter of willpower. But what you're saying, there are fundamental changes in the brain itself that you have to deal with.
What we are saying now, based on many studies doing imaging of the brain, looking at the neurophysiology of the brain, looking at the genetic factors that put some people at much higher risk than others, is that it's not a moral flaw, it's an operational flaw. These modules that are supposed to work in tandem and in proper balance are now out of balance, which even though it begins with a voluntary action of beginning to use a drug for the first time, it's really a Russian roulette, and it's impossible to know, very difficult to predict, who will then become onto a path, a trajectory that will lead to full-blown addiction.
I want to go back to something you said a minute ago when you talked about the ever-expanding wave of dysfunction. What does that look like biologically? Does it mean fewer synapses or more?
It's not fewer or more. It's really, we're going back to the first concept that I brought up, which is about learning. The brain is a very plastic organ, and the way we design our brain during development is really taking synapses out, taking points of contact that are not used, and adding new ones that are used. Those that are not used are lost, are weakened, and those that we use over and over again become strengthened. So this is the process of pruning and sculpting of the brain, particularly active during development. So this is a process, in a way, of learning. This is how the brain learns, by designing circuitry that is a function of the experience. The experience really shapes the architecture of the brain. So it's just that the brain of an addict becomes shaped by that experience in a very powerful way. You can see that in imaging studies. If you look at, for example, when we go back to the very center of addiction, of the addiction process, the beginning, we talk about the reward centers of the brain. There you can see, if you look at the receptors that are supposed to bind dopamine, we see a reduction in the level of dopamine receptors. And this is a way of the brain, in that particular part of the brain, the reward centers, a way of trying to adapt to the very loud noise of dopamine that the drugs tend to cause. And it's like covering your ears when you are confronted with a very loud noise in a radio, for example. The result of that is that the person now is less sensitive, not only to the drug, which is an artificial reward, but also to all sorts of natural rewards, like food, going out with friends, sex. So this is the beginning of the addicted trajectory. When you really begin to feel impaired in your ability to feel not just drug rewards, but any sort of reward.
So then age must influence what effects drugs will have on your brain. Is it easier to get addicted at a younger age?
Absolutely, because you can think of the young brain as a brain that is being programmed. Everything that the young person is doing goes into that program as lines of code, if you want. Drug exposure, watching TV, using the cell phone, doing sports, everything. Everything becomes part of the experience, which eventually goes down into some kind of a line of a code and into a program. So the problem is that the active period where we humans write those programs, those developmental programs in the brain, is during the pre-adolescence, adolescence, and young adulthood, somewhere between 12 years of age and 23, 25 years of age. There is this active peak of brain programming, if you will. So using a drug during that window of vulnerability really is like shuffling or reshuffling the letters in the keyboard that the person is using to program the brain. Now, if you reshuffle the keyboard after the program is written, that is when you're an adult, you can expect some problems running the program. We call that intoxication. That would be temporary because the program is written. However, if you reshuffle the letters in the keyboard while you are actively programming your brain or writing those lines of code, you can expect some glitches or bugs to be embedded in the program. Those will be much harder to get rid of. And that's a way of explaining why the young brain, which is actively developing, is so much more at risk of becoming addicted later on in life.
Some of my research I've read says that you get addicted faster to opioids. Is that true?
The liability, the addiction liability of different drugs differ. For example, if you look at the entire population of the United States, about half of the population is exposed at some point or another regularly to alcohol. Only 10% of those, roughly, will show any signs of addiction, dependence to alcohol. Tobacco is more addictive, about 30%. Opiates are somewhat more addictive, probably 50 to 60% range if they are misused. So the addiction liability really varies with the drug. Different drugs have different levels of liability. And that has to do with the pharmacology, the way they interact with this dopamine circuitry. All drugs of abuse, in one way or another, directly or indirectly, have this confluence. They affect, they impact the dopaminergic transmission, the way that the brain uses dopamine to process reward and predict rewards. So different drugs have different potencies and different mechanisms whereby they do this. And that's really reflected in their different addiction liabilities.
Where do scientists still disagree about the biology of addiction?
That's a very tough question. Really, I would think that it's in the details. And perhaps there is some disagreement as to how much of a disease is and whether volition, how do we understand consciousness and pleasure. We have the concept of the heart problem. Where is pleasure encoded? And what is the actual role of dopamine in terms of predicting the differential between expectation, anticipation, and pleasure? So these are really details.
What do you still want to know about addiction?
I see addiction not just as a disease, but also as a symptom. As a symptom that reflects different things for different people. For some people, for example, who start early, it just exposes this tendency to take risks when you're young. It's a symptom of somebody who doesn't have access to mental health services and gravitates towards alcohol or sedatives to treat, to self-medicate. Obviously, that's a misuse of a drug, but a lot of people have these comorbid conditions, and in a system that in which many people fall through the cracks, it's not that uncommon to find people who are forced to self-medicate and they gravitate towards drugs in that way. So addiction is not just a disease, but it's also a symptom of cracks in our social system, in our fabric of mental and physical healthcare. So I would like to for science to really address, and policymakers to really address those gaps, because when we are confronted with somebody who's addicted, it's already late. It's too late, and it's very difficult to revert. I would like to see more resources, more research into that part, perhaps less sexy part of the equation, which is prevention. Let's get serious about prevention at all levels of the equation.
Dr. Baller, thank you so much for talking with me.
It was really my pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
That was Dr. Ruben Baller with the National Institute on Drug Abuse.